Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
Hello there and welcome to the weekend podcast on this May bank holiday weekend. Follow us on Spotify for this weekly selection of our favourite chats from the last couple of days. On this episode, U2 legend and the Baron of Bass himself with the best hair in rock and roll, Adam Clayton. He talked to us about sustainability and his love of gardening in Dublin. The best-selling crime writer Jane Casey also joined us to talk about her latest novel and her relationship to Pat Kenny. And our visiting critic, Eimear McLysett, went out and drove a double-decker Dublin bus and reviewed it for you. So into the podcast we go. Enjoy. Now, our next guest has 22 Grammys. He's sold hundreds of millions of albums, but nothing makes him quite as happy as his Dublin garden, where the magnolia trees put on a show to rival U2. And he's going to be speaking about nature and sustainability at a fashion and farming festival, would you believe? It's happening in Cork. He also is the man with the greatest hair in bass player rock and roll history. Adam Clayton, good morning.
Good morning, Oliver. That's quite an intro. I hope I can live up to it.
Absolutely no doubt about it. We know you have a huge interest in gardening in the natural world from your own woodland gardens that have featured in Gardener's World on BBC last year. You've been working on these gardens for over 30 years.
Yeah, I was very lucky that early on in life, I was able to buy, you know, a house that I thought would serve me for the rest of my life. And it happened to have 17 acres of kind of overmature woodlands. And rather than just sit and look at it, I thought, okay, well, let's get stuck in here and I'll just plant some trees and I'll get the benefit of that later on in life. And that sort of just turned into a bit of an obsession. And ultimately, you know, I went down to Mount Congreve and I saw the magnolia displays down there and the camellias. And I thought I'd love to have a bit of that up at my house in Dublin. So I started to plant magnolias and I am getting the benefit of them now because those trees are now 30 years old and 20 and 30 metres high.
Because they could take a couple of years. You have to be very patient with magnolias. They could take some years to bloom. Is that right?
Oh, they're coy creatures. Yeah, they won't show you their blooms for a while. So, I mean, not all of them are so reticent, but 5 or 6 years before you see anything.
I was talking to gardeners only recently about magnolias, and they were saying, no, don't bother with them. They're a waste. They'll bloom for a fortnight in March and April if you're lucky, and then nothing for the year.
But that's the whole point.
But I'm sure you have different varieties that kind of bloom. They can bloom till June, can they?
Yeah, there are some later blooms. But actually, the point is that they bloom, you know, when there's no green on anything. And, you know, they just give you hope that spring is coming.
They do look a bit spectacular because there's no leaves anywhere on them. They're like little ice cream scoops of colour, pinks and whites, presumably yellows as well.
Yeah, so you get the magnolias, you get the camellias, you get the rhododendrons, and you get the bulbs all kind of happening around the same time. And it's just, I think it's a wonderful display. And it's a way of bringing forward the spring and bringing forward the summer. And you know the seasons are going to follow each other.
Rhododendrons now, mentioning them in Ireland, people go, no, they'll invade everything. But obviously you've got the nice ones, the kind ones.
Yeah, I mean, I think the common ones that you see in all the hedgerows and everything, I mean, I know people complain about them, but I actually think they're a great kind of natural species that we have, and I'm always happy to see them. But yeah, over the years, you know, I've planted some more exotic specimens, and they take a long time as well. I mean, whenever I visit historic Irish gardens, I'm always interested in looking at the rhododendrons and how well they've done.
Is that something you do often, wandering into historic houses in Ireland and searching the gardens?
Well, because of where I am in Rathfarnham, I've got access to a lot of the Wicklow gardens. Yeah. So at different times, I'll go down to them, see them at different times of year. And, you know, I know some of the people there, and my head gardener, Dara, knows a lot of them. So if I've got time, I love just pottering about, putting on an old anorak, and off I go, you know.
And you come back with ideas for what to do in your gardens.
And if I'm lucky, a few plants.
Oh, yes. Are you a hands-on gardener yourself? Because I know you have a head gardener and you have people working there, because nobody could do this on their own.
Well, these days I'm not so handy with a spade, but certainly in the early days when it was just me and another fella, we'd be digging holes and cleaning things out and everything. But those days, I'm afraid, are a little gone now behind me.
Oh dear, that must be just a personal choice.
Partly, I'm away a lot, but you know, yeah. I'm not always around at the appropriate times. You know, I'd love to be, and it's obviously a place of great solace. But I feel if I can get out in the garden regularly and take a walk around and make a note of a few ideas, and then, you know, talk to the team, then that's the most use I can be.
There's a brilliant story, isn't there? Because you were in school next door, looking over the wall at these grounds once upon a time.
Yeah, these grounds were my escape from I was in a boarding school, and you know, if you're in a place of internment like that, you spend a lot of time looking over the wall, imagining what life might be like. And I used to look into this garden and think, oh, that looks like an amazing place. And I'd never come into it from, you know, up through the front gate or anything. So many years later, when we were renting a house for Joshua Tree, I arrived up through the front gate, and it took me a while to realize that this was the house right next to the school that I knew quite well. So it was just that it was serendipitous that it was there, that we were working there, and it then made sense to make an offer at the end of the recording process, and I was lucky enough to get it.
Was the M50 on its way, or had been built at that stage, because it was nearby?
Yeah, I knew the M50 was coming. I mean, it was pre the M50. It was extraordinary. It was so silent at the weekends, and yeah. you could hear people playing sport down in Marley Park. It would kind of roll up the hill. Obviously, the M50 changed all that, but it didn't actually hit my land. So I felt like I was lucky enough to have a good buffer, but. You know, it kind of really helped, because I can get to the airport in about 20-30 minutes on a good run.
But obviously the trees help block out a lot of the sound, and that would have been part of the campaign, the project.
You would think that they would do that, but actually they're not great at absorbing sound.
Really?
It's really the prevailing winds that make the most difference.
Right. How many trees do you reckon you've planted there in those near 30 years?
I've probably been responsible for planting about 4,000.
Really?
But of course, when you do that, you know, there's a lot of wastage, because you have to thin them at various stages as well. But it's a lot of trees, and I'm very committed to planting trees. I think deforestation of the countryside is a terrible thing. I think woodlands are kind of magical places. They're great resources to be able to walk through.
And there's obviously loads of it's a wild habitat for a lot of creatures. I think I read somewhere that you adopted hedgehogs and released them into your garden. Is that true?
I have become a bit of a hedgehog father, yeah. Linda Martin, who runs a dog refuge, I was visiting her, and I was interviewing her for some Showband documentary I was doing.
Oh yeah.
And she happened to have some hedgehogs, and I just think they're kind of magical creatures. And my daughter is an 8-year-old, and she's very interested in them as well. So I took them home. I'm sort of interested in the rewilding movement, although it's not something that that I do up at Danesmoat so much. But if you have a lot of land, the idea of turning it back to the way it would be before there was any intervention by modern farming methods or land control methods is something I'm interested in. And Isabella Tree, who was behind the rewilding at Knepp House in England. I interviewed her once at the Boris Literary Festival, yeah. And very interesting woman, very interesting what they've done there and what they've been able to achieve.
When you go back into the gardens, because you're out of the country at the minute, is there something particularly you look forward to that you're excited about seeing when you go back into the woodlands that you're looking out for, and particularly as you're coming into the days of May?
You know, in a way, it's always the trees because I kind of notice how much growth they've put on, and because we're always in a process of thinning and sort of making space, it's I'm kind of looking at how the form has changed and what it offers us. I mean, I actually just love the walking as well. I mean, there's something nice to be walking, you know, amongst the trees and the dappled light that we get.
And there's a lovely river running through it, I could see on that yeah. BBC programme.
Well, it's more of a stream than a river, but it becomes a river in the winter.
What do you get out of it when you're strolling around the woodlands?
I think I get right-sized. You know, I spend a lot of time running around the place, sort of in aeroplanes or in vans going places and whatever. And there's something quite nice about just being reduced to how far can I walk in 10 minutes and what will I see? You know, nature's there before any of us, and it's probably going to be there long after we've all gone. It has a different kind of time scale than we do.
Yeah, right size is a lovely way of putting it, because I know you've oak trees and they're really long. They've long stories, oak trees.
Yeah, I love the oak trees. And oaks will, of course, survive over very long periods of time. And you know, we're learning more and more about the sort of plant kingdom and the way that the trees communicate
with each other
and are connected to each other.
It's bizarre, isn't it? They kind of communicate through their roots.
Yeah.
Does anyone else in U2 talk about gardening in the same way that you do?
I don't think so. I'm just a particular kind of a character. I think because I was in schools, boarding schools from the age of eight, and they were always set in quite remote but nice places, even though the experience was not so good. So I got great solace and strength from being outdoors. It was one of those things that really helped me with that feeling of isolation.
It really does sound like you didn't like boarding school.
I was in boarding school at a time where they weren't very hospitable places, and it didn't suit me. I was sensitive and creative. Yeah. I was not rough and tough and sporty. You know, I didn't want to play football and rugby and beat the shite out of the other kids.
not good at sport. Thank God you had a talent. And you saw that notice in the school that Larry Mullen Jr. put up looking for people to join a band. That's 50 years next year, September 1976. And you two, of course, great at planning those big occasions far, far out. Is this an anniversary you're thinking about marking?
You know, we know it's there. We know it's coming along. We are not particularly going to celebrate it, though, you know, these things are very hard to predict. But I'm sure, you know, whilst we, you know, we might not be able to align an album or a tour to celebrate that moment, I'm sure we'll be opening a bottle of champagne on the day.
The Edge has been teasing everybody recently in interviews about new music on the way. Have you any updates for us, Adam?
Oh, he's been teasing me as well. I have. The only thing I can say is that it's a work in progress.
All right.
And We do not have a deadline as such, but I would hope that by the end of the year we would have some information to share, and perhaps we could suggest something for next year.
Oh, it's like the magnolias. We won't hear anything for a while, and then they bloom beautifully.
Yeah, exactly.
At the edge, I'm looking at the quote in Rolling Stone. We're recording science fiction Irish folk music with Brian Eno. Is that something you've heard of?
That sounds about right.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Sci-fi Irish folk music.
Yeah, I think that's. I think we're heading off in that direction.
Fascinating. Okay. Now, the Sphere was the last major thing we saw you two doing, and of course, poor Larry had to sit that out. We haven't heard or seen much of Larry Mullen in a while. Is he okay now?
Yeah, he's absolutely. You know, he's back behind his kit. He's got his sticks out, and he's great. He's great, better than ever. Bionic Man.
He missed the Sphere, and it was probably weird for a bit, was it? Being a threesome, obviously with some help on the drums, but not being the pure foursome.
Yeah, you never like to go out there, you know, not at full strength. And you know, he's been in our gang, he's one of us right from day one, so that was difficult. But you know, it was also, you know, it's nice to be able to say, okay, you go get your stuff done. You need some, you know, you need a little bit of maintenance, and you know, get right, get fixed, and you know, we'll keep your seat warm for you.
Which you did. For a man who loves the natural world, those gigs, 40 gigs in the Sphere, September 23 to March of last year, how did you find those, being in such a massive dome of technology?
It's, you know, you're out in the desert, you're inside, you're in air conditioning all the time, but you know, that is the nature of the working world for us, or certainly for me, is, you know, you are in an urban environment most of the time, but it's, you know, it's the contrast, it's the difference. It's, you know, if you're a musician, that's your job. You have to get in a bus and go travel and meet the audience wherever they are. And it just so happens that they tend to be in kind of urban areas. And that's what you do.
I want to ask you about Fashion and Farming. This festival is happening in Cork that you're speaking about. What are you going to tell them there in Kinsale?
Well, I'm basically in Kinsale, and I'm turning up for Fashion and Farming because I want to find out what it's all about. I want to, you know, I'm there to learn. And I think the idea of Fashion and Farming being linked is an amazing idea and a very exciting idea. I don't think it's about, you know, farmers wearing silk scarves for the farming for the ploughing championships.
Yeah, okay. I think well, that's a nice idea.
I think there's more to it than personal style. And it's kind of interesting that the fashion industry, particularly when you focus on fast fashion, you know, it is the second highest user of water, and it is indeed the second polluter after the petrol and oil and gas industries. So, you know, it's a serious problem that we have to change the way we look at it and the way we value it. And of course, farming needs to change if we're going to protect the soil and be sustaining. So these are all issues that I'm interested in, and I'm very curious to see what the panel of speakers will say. You know, we have the land gardeners there, which is Bridget Ellsworthy and Henrietta Courtauld, who, you know, are very progressive about how one treats the soil. Yeah. I think there's going to be some interesting chats. We've got Doreena Allen there as well. And I think it's going to be a really good weekend. It's the first one. It's obviously going to grow and change. But I think there'll be something to learn and plenty of people to interact with. Mairead McGuinness is doing a talk as well. So plenty for everyone.
And you're there for 2 days. Very generous with your time on the 10th and 11th of May in beautiful.
Well, you know, I like Kinsale. I think it's a wonderful part of the world, and any excuse to be down there, and I'll be there.
It really sounds like you get around Ireland quite a lot, which is lovely to hear. Adam Clayton, thank you so much for your time. Adam's going to be speaking at the Fashion and Farming Festival, Kinsale, County Cork, 10th and 11th of May. You can go to fashionandfarming.com for tickets.
Yeah, thank you so much, Oliver, and maybe see you there.
Absolutely. So long. Thanks, Adam.
Thanks, Ben.
Now, Jane Casey was working as a children's book editor in London when a draft of a crime novel landed her a book deal. And since then, she's won loads of awards. She's topped the book charts all around the place with thrillers. And they're acclaimed for their realism and the accuracy, especially the Maeve Kerrigan detective series, Irish Maeve, of course. And the latest has just been released. It's called The Secret Room. And Jane Casey is home to Dublin to tell us all about it. Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Good to see you again.
It's so nice to be here.
I was only chatting to you before Christmas in the Irish Book of the Year program, and that was book 11.
It was book 11,
and
yeah.
You're out already with the next one because you.
Well, it makes me laugh when you say that because obviously this book came out on Thursday, last Thursday,
yeah.
And I've already had messages from people saying, "When is the next one coming out? Have you started writing it yet? How far are you on in writing the next one?"
This is old hat for some of them already.
They want it by Christmas if possible, and which is not possible.
You have mad fans, don't you?
I've got great fans.
Oh, I meant mad in a good way, of course.
Yes, yeah. They are, I mean, they are obsessive in the nicest way possible. And I actually dedicated the book to the readers this time because they are so, like, there's people who take a day off work just to read the book when it comes out. There's people who
don't say that. That's what they're up to at the day.
I assume that they're very honest people. I don't ask too many questions.
But literally somebody got in touch like overnight. It came out at midnight somewhere, did it? And by the next morning you had messages. When's the next one?
Oh, people will read it straight away because they don't want to be spoiled. Like, they want to know what happens in it and they don't want anyone to ruin it for them.
You're based in England. You've been living there. How long have you been living there now?
Oh my God, too long. Since 2003.
Oh, brilliant. And because it's a huge market for you, obviously, with the volume there, it does extremely well. What is it about Irish crime writing? Why is it, it feels like it's much bigger now than it was even in recent years?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's just so much talent in that area of writing at the moment. I mean, like, we always kind of punch above our weight anyway as writers in every genre, but crime is kind of new, that it's the last few years that people have really picked up on it. And what I love about it is that we're all so different. Like, everybody's writing a very different kind of crime novel, but the quality is there.
It is, for sure. And why does Maeve Kerrigan feel like such a friend to people? Because we're 12 books in, but you could kind of pick up any one, really, couldn't you? You could start from there.
Yeah, I mean, people frequently read them out of order. And I actually think I quite like that. Like, I like people to kind of come in near the end and then work out what's going on. I think just, there aren't that many genres where you get to write 12 books about one character and follow them through and have, like, their kind of personal life running alongside the rest of the story. So there's always the mystery, the crime, but then Maeve's problems go on from book to book.
There's a kind of a Mulder and Scully style relationship, isn't there?
I mean, I've heard it described that way. Yeah. there's a will they, won't they?
There is, what I would say. Yeah. I'm thinking book 12 because book 11 was the first I read. And now there's this one, and I'm going, is the question going to be answered at some point, or is it, you can't say?
I'm not going to spoil anything for anyone.
No, that's Josh and Maeve.
Josh and Maeve.
And her Irishness does emerge every now and again.
Yes, so she has, her parents are very heavily involved in her life. She's two Irish parents. She grew up in London, but she sort of has that dual heritage. So she's like, you know, she's very much an Irish person in London. And they are so heavily involved in her life. And I think for English readers, they're like, is that normal?
Does that seem unusual to English readers?
Very much so, yeah. Yeah, they really, they love it, but they're not used to it. Whereas I think, like, your mother knows everything about you. And nobody else is allowed to criticise you, but she'll put the boot in.
It's those margins between helpful and interfering that we haven't quite sorted out.
Yeah, exactly. They're in your business.
How do the English look at it? Do they see it as interfering if a mammy is too close to...
They honestly just don't, like, they might go home twice a year and have, like, a very polite little meal and then leave again, and that's that's how it goes.
Because maybe she bumps into an Irish person in this one and they have a little kind of a discussion over are you too much this way and too little the other? That's the sort of dual thing. Does that affect you, despite the fact that you're born and bred Castleknock, I think, was home.
That's right.
But I mean, like, you're 20 plus years and your family and everything.
I don't do that sum. That's like, the only time I've ever felt really like I wasn't able to come home was during the pandemic. And that was the first time, because it's so easy. Like, you hop on a plane and you're here and you're back and it's home to me.
Mm-hmm. It feels close, but when we go to London, it's like, oh, this is a proper world city that doesn't understand anything about us. And that's when you sort of feel like, oh, that's where the disjointing comes, I think.
Yeah, we're very familiar with them. I always feel like we're like spies living among them right, because yeah. They have no idea that we're there kind of watching them and judging them. I don't think that they think of us as being very different. And I think there's a huge cultural gap there.
Do they think of us at all?
I think they, in a kind of a fond and patronising way sometimes.
Really?
I'm speaking of my husband here.
Which you can indeed. Your husband's very useful for the crime novels.
Yes, he is. He's terrific. He's a criminal barrister. So he is in that world of kind of crime. And if he doesn't know the answer to something, he knows somebody who knows the answer.
Really?
So, yeah, okay. He's very useful.
So is he your first reader then when it comes to...
Like with a gun to his head. He's not a fiction reader, so he only does it like he kind of grits his teeth through it. But what he really is looking for is anywhere where one of his good lines has made it into the book. Sometimes he says things and I can see him looking at me and going like, is that going to be something Josh says? Like
really?
Waiting to see, do I write it down? I do not.
He's a criminal barrister who sees the dark underbelly of society all the time, doesn't he? So
yes.
That's a dark place to dwell. Does he carry it home with him?
Sometimes. I mean, I think anybody who has dealings with people who are in really the worst place in their lives, they have to take it home with them sometimes.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a job that he does because he really believes in it. And there's a kind of a moral sort of vocation, if you like, to go and work in that part of the law and to do the best job that he can there.
So he has the English perspective of Irishness. But did he go to college here?
No, I went to college in England.
You went,
that's where we met. But he has...
To Oxford. Very nice.
He has family here. So he's always had like a bit of a connection with Ireland. So I didn't have to start from the beginning and explain everything to him.
What was it like being an Irish youngster in Oxford?
I mean, I look back on it. I think at the time I kind of took it in my stride, as you do when you're 18. But I look back on it and think, my goodness, it was such an odd place to be. And... it was very unfamiliar. It was very Harry Potter. Like, it really was
really?
What they say about it. I remember walking out of my college one morning and seeing a whole group of guys with a pack of hounds and they were going to go hunting.
Oh, really?
And I was like, this is the middle of a city. What's happening here?
That's weird.
Yeah, it was weird.
But there must be people from all over the world. I mean, you couldn't feel too out of place, presume. Or is there a real intense Englishness about Oxford?
I mean, it is a very English place, but I was in a college that's associated with Wales. So there were lots of Welsh people and they're lovely. And so there was a kind of a nice, exactly, there was a Celtic fringe aspect to it.
They have that view that they're not thinking about us either.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which must be worse when you're on the same island.
We bonded. Yeah, they can never get away.
So you met in Oxford. Whirlwind romance?
No, it was a long drawn out situation where I was pursued. No, he turned into my best friend, which is lovely.
Okay.
But not for him, because he did not want to be my best friend.
Oh, I see. Oh, so this sounds like the plot. This sounds like the Maeve Kerrigan, Josh thing.
There was a will they, won't they in real life. There was. But yeah, that was resolved.
That one was resolved. Tell us about the plot of this one, because it opens with a locked room mystery. And this is where your fans love to go. They love to find out how you're going to solve this one, essentially.
This is it begins with a very wealthy woman going to a luxury hotel, as she does every Wednesday, for an afternoon with a man who is not her husband. And an hour later, she is dead. She's in a scalding hot bath.
This is quite graphic.
I didn't think it was that bad. And I was reading back over it and I thought, actually, this is kind of gruesome. I see where people have a problem here.
I had to jump in with a warning there. I'm sorry. The air of the day and so on. But there is a gruesome death involving scalding water.
She's in a scalding hot bath and there's no way that she can have been murdered. And yet she has been.
Because no one else has come in and out of the room. The CCTV captures the fella who visits, as
That's
he does
right.
every Wednesday.
Yeah.
And it doesn't appear he's done it.
He doesn't have time to do it.
No.
So it's a proper mystery.
And Maeve, who's very good at spotting everything, including people's luggage and where they've just flown in from with the codes and so on, that you have all cleverly put in to tell the newcomers that this is a very sharp detective. She has to solve this frustrating mystery. And then you just throw in another crazy mystery.
Just throw in another. Yeah. So she's just kind of getting to grips with this. And then Josh is arrested and he is in real trouble this time. And she has to try and get him out of that trouble that he's in.
And her parents are very useful to her because they're obviously Irish parents.
They are. Story. They step in. They help. So she has a lot of support from them, but obviously it comes with the comments and the input that she might not necessarily appreciate.
But the mother is a strong woman, isn't she? And she gives very useful advice.
Yeah, there's a bit where Maeve says if she had been a detective, then there wouldn't have been a crime for 20 miles because she spots everything. She misses nothing.
Proper Irish mammy.
Absolutely.
Your own parents were around when you started having the parents in the novels. Did they spot themselves in Maeve's?
Yeah, my mum loved it. She loved it. But she was, she absolutely loved whenever Mrs. Kerrigan turned up. But she would try and see herself in her.
That's right. Would she give you little suggestions on what to do with Mammy Kerrigan every now and again?
She would definitely have complained if I'd done something she disapproved of. But no, she was just happy to read them.
And you went through a torrid time, didn't you? You lost both your parents within a year of each other, is that right?
That's right. Yeah, almost exactly a year.
And it was one of those terrible, ghastly COVID era funerals.
It was.
When did your mum pass away?
It was the Christmas. She actually died on Christmas Day in 2020. So it
wow.
was a very kind of traumatic thing to have that happen, and to have it happen on Christmas Day She loved Christmas. She'd always been, you know, a big person to celebrate. And we always had the big family celebrations. And so it was very her actually to go on that day. And we had the tiny, tiny funeral. And I just, there was something so sad about the whole thing.
But
so many other people were going through the same thing. So actually, I think maybe we weren't all able to be together at that time, but people have really bonded over it afterwards and kind of understand that we all went through the same thing.
Very quietly, those people who, you know, very patiently put up with those funerals, those tiny funerals at a time of massive grief. I haven't talked about it a lot since. They're almost afraid to bring it up because nobody wants to talk about the lockdowns era. I don't know how you feel about it.
Oh, I mean, something that we all want to put behind us, really. And it's funny because not that many people have written about it. Like, it hasn't kind of come into books at all.
That's right, yeah.
I think Catherine Ryan Howard is the only person who's really written. I mean, she wrote the pandemic novel, of 56 Days.
Concurrently, while it was still happening. Yeah.
While it was happening. But she's the only person who I think has actually tackled it and done it well. And I tried to bring it into a book and then I took it out again.
Why was that?
I just didn't really want to revisit it. It just felt like a time that I want to leave behind me.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about your mum, because your parents had such an intense relationship that your dad essentially died of a broken heart. Is that?
That's basically it. Yeah, he was. They had. There was quite an age gap between them, and he was older. So he was always. I think he'd always expected that he would be the one who would go first, or everybody had. I think there were 16 years between them.
Yeah, yeah.
And when she died, I think he felt like his work on this earth was done. So he didn't really want to be around anymore. And I just remember sitting beside him and thinking he was the loneliest man I'd ever met. And I was sitting beside him, but I couldn't do anything to alleviate that loneliness. He was just so unhappy.
The grief was such a chasm that he couldn't cross.
Absolutely.
As you say, a 16-year gap, he probably was planning all his life that he was going to go first. And then he was left with this unexpected loss.
Yeah, and an empty house. And, you know, he just felt, I think, once he had sorted out all his affairs, he just waited until it was his time to go. And it was like basically exactly a year.
Really?
So, yeah.
And how was he in that year? Was he in pain?
He was. And he was just very, I mean, he was in his 90s. So he had got to a great age, but I think he had just found he couldn't enjoy anything anymore. So it was like even little things like a cup of tea, he just didn't want it. He'd just sit and not want it. He was finished with this world.
That must be very difficult as a child of someone, and with his grandchildren as well in tow, and everybody, you know, you're gunning for him to keep living. That must be tough to watch.
It was hard. But I felt, you know, when he died, I felt he was at peace and he was happy, and they're buried together. They're in the same grave. And it, like, there's something very nice about knowing that they're there. And I remember the day of his funeral, it was he was buried at the beginning of January, and it was a perishingly cold day. Like there was ice everywhere and it was bitter. And just when we were at the graveside, the sun came out and there was this lovely warm kind of sunlight. And I thought, if that's a message from them, I'll take it.
That's the thing. So you're kind of at peace with it in the end. That it's rare people get that sort of calm farewell in so many ways. It was obviously still lockdown time. It was only a year later.
It was. And it was traumatic for me because I was coming over from England to see him. And do you remember you had to have tests? Like you had to go and be swabbed and be tested. Yeah, yeah. And I was coming.
And wait for the results and the text. Oh my God.
And you couldn't travel unless you had the right text and you had the right information. And I just remember I was waiting to go in and have the swab done. And my sister rang me and said that he died. And I went in and I said to the guy who was doing it, I said, I'm sorry, like I've just heard my dad died. And he looked at me and he said, my father died 3 months ago. And then he started crying and I started crying. And the two of us were there, like, just we had this like really lovely moment together.
A shared moment.
Yeah. Like this is a thing that everybody goes through.
The COVID era bereaved. Yeah. It's like it's a very different thing to everything else. And you were flying over and back. So obviously this was all happening in Dublin and you were coming from England. Was that a funeral as well with just a handful of people, a second one?
I think we were able to have more people at that one.
It was opened up a little bit.
Yeah, there were more people there. And that was nice. It's nice to have that kind of support. Like that's what you missed in COVID. It's having, you know, these people who really cared about you and your family. And that's the great thing about Ireland. Like the fact that funerals in England are invitation only, I think says a lot about how they deal with things.
Who gets asked to the afters, so on, isn't it?
It's very...
It can get political.
They're not comfortable with someone just turning up for fun.
I'm sorry you went through all of that. That was the difficult part. And obviously, long before that, you tried to move back to Dublin and the whole family.
That's right. Yeah, we had I think, the worst possible year you could have. I think, like... Just, you know, as an example, one of the things that went wrong was we were burgled, but we weren't just burgled. We were burgled right after Christmas and they took all the kids' presents.
No.
It's that level of bad luck that we had. Like,
okay, so what year is this?
This would have been, I was trying to work it out, I think it was 2017.
2017. So your career is going really well.
Everything was flying. Everything was fine.
The kids are young. And you say, we can move over to Ireland. We can make a go at this. So this is your dream, isn't it?
This is always my dream.
Your English husband, he's up for it.
He was, and like, he's very pro-Ireland. He's very, he was delighted.
The joshing. Was he going to take a step back from work for a period, was he?
We were going to try and like manage it between ourselves. Like he would go over to do trials, but actually he could do a lot from home.
Very good.
So it was all going to work. We planned everything. We had... done our due diligence and done our research.
Does it go well at the beginning even? There's no good patch.
There was no point where it went well.
Take us through it. What happened?
Oh, God. I mean, one of the things that went wrong was I wrote a really terrible book. It wasn't a Maeve book. It was a standalone, but it was terrible. Oh, yeah. And it got, my editor was really nice about it. And she said, I think it's going to need a lot of work. And I said, is it actually salvageable? And she said, no.
Wow. So, and this is saying it to someone who's been selling very well and they're saying, this, we're not publishing this book.
That's right. So immediately, no money coming in from that. No. Like,
and
it
you
was,
start another book.
Start another book, which is another Maeve. And I was actually really happy with that book. And
as were the fans.
It was meant to be. This is what I feel about it. But it did break my heart. Like I was very lucky in love always, but I think Dublin broke my heart when I had to leave it.
And that's not all that goes wrong, unfortunately.
Never really got over it. Oh, my goodness, what else went wrong? My son had an accident in school. He was nearly killed. He was actually fine, but it was an accident that could have killed him. And it was a window fell on his head, basically. Like one of those big school windows fell out of the frame and pinned him to his desk. And I just thought, there's something, someone is trying to get us to leave. Like, this cannot be right, that we're in the right place.
That's wild.
Yeah. I remember his teacher was just sheet white when I came to pick him up because he'd seen it happen. So, yeah.
This is how lucky this kid is.
Very traumatic.
Is that the point you decide, right, this is not working out, we're going back?
I think that was really the point where we were like, we had no money, we had no, nobody was happy.
Santa Claus's gifts have been stolen.
I mean, that was honestly, that was like, it was rubbing it in, wasn't it? It was like, wasn't that's just pretty, burgling the house.
That's a sign you take. And you go back to London. Does the curse end when you return?
Unbelievably, immediately.
Immediately?
The second we got back, things started to kind of pick up again. And I think the main thing was that the children were really happy. They went back to the same school. Everybody was delighted to see them. And the funny thing was the children in the school were told that they were coming back. So they came home and they said, oh, the boys are coming back. And their parents were going, no, they've left. They're not coming back. Like, I don't know where you got that idea, but they were dead
they
right.
They returned. Okay. And how do you feel about it now? Because you say Dublin broke your heart. You really wanted to make it work.
I think Dublin is always going to be there. And I think I haven't given up on coming back, but it won't be for another couple of years. And when we do, okay. It will be very much, very carefully, we'll get a burglar alarm. That'll be one thing.
You need every black cat to walk across your
path. Every black cat, every single possible bit of luck that we can scrape together. But it hasn't gone away. And I think I would, you know, I'd be very happy to come back. And in the meantime, I just try and come over as much as I can.
But in the meantime, I presume you love London, you love life there, and you've met nice friends and people, and your kids have the dual heritage going on.
That's right. They have the experience of living there, and there are loads of good things about London. There are lots of nice things about it as well. But like, people complain about London in a way they don't complain about other places.
They complain about the things that we wish we had, don't they? Going, isn't the tube terrible? It's like, no, it's the best thing. It runs slowly sometimes and runs a bit late, but we don't have anything.
Yeah, but I think it's magic. And then I think I never leave myself enough time to get anywhere because I'm like, I can just go on the tube. It's grand. I'll be fine.
The expectation. And it just runs late as well. Imagine the idea of public transport that runs after 11:30 on a weekend night. They do tend to complain about those things. So you're English now, Jane. Is that right? No, she never will. I have to ask you about your famous relative.
My famous relative.
Who I didn't believe when they told me in here. I was going, well, that's a bit of an age gap there between yourself and PK.
Pat Kenny, yes, he's my cousin. I think my dad was older. So my dad was of the generation above. And so, Pat is my cousin.
What was it like growing up when, obviously you were a kid, when Pat is everywhere?
I mean, he's always just been a lovely person to have in the family. And my sister was a very precocious child, and she used to, whenever she saw him on TV when she was very little, she would say, "The Pat." So he was the Pat. So he was always the Pat in our house. And he's just a great person to have in the family.
Has he interviewed you?
He has.
Oh, he has?
I never mentioned that he was related to me, or I was related to him, I should say. Until he said it. Like, I was like, I don't want to kind of make it look as if I'm going,
very nice,
please pay attention to me. I'm actually Pat Kenny's cousin. No, but he said
Have you
it.
Read the new novel written by Pat Kenny's cousin?
That's what it would have been. Let's face it.
So you wait until he became big and then the news is out. What's it like? What's it like being interviewed by your first cousin? That must feel strange.
He's so professional. He's such a pro. Like, you'd never know. And he's, you know, he makes it very easy.
Does he correct you on some of the criminal terminology and outcomes of the novels? That's what I feel Pat might do.
I would always be a bit nervous going in just in case, in case I've got something wrong and he'll spot it. I know, he's great.
Big Daddy, I think is what they used to call him in RT back in the day. Makes a difference from the Pat. Your fans are on to us, Jane. I love the Maeve Kerrigan series. Finish The Secret Room on Friday night. They've all read it already. Brilliant again. Bring on the next book from another Maeve.
Oh, very nice.
Do the English point out the Irishness of Maeve to you when they're chatting to you at book signings and so on?
They like it, but they can't spell it.
Really?
And I think it's a very easy name to spell.
Especially because you've used the V, you've used the anglicised
version. Yeah, I didn't
even
do the M-E-D-H-B-H version, which I was tempted to.
I'd say so, yeah. The publishers would probably have a word with you, I'd say, if you managed
They'd
to
have kittens, I think.
Okay, well, you might as well tell us when is the next one, because they all want to know.
The next one actually is not going to be out next year. It's the year after. I have a standalone coming next year, but it's my first book set in Ireland. So it is a big thing for me to have a book set in Ireland.
Oh, this one's coming to... The standalone will be in Ireland.
Standalone will be set in Ireland.
Step outside the Maeve Kerrigan.
No Maeve, but there may be some Maeve-related stuff.
Will it be all Dublin? Because that's the patch you know the best.
Mayo and Dublin and a couple of other places.
Mayo is the connection to...
My mum.
Your mum was a Mayo woman?
Yeah, she was born in Mayo.
There's a strong pull on Mayo identity, isn't there?
There is. Oh, Mayo's the best county, I think.
And it's going to be crime fiction again?
It is going to be crime fiction again.
Oh, you'll really have to invent it because nothing bad ever happens in Mayo.
Oh, no, yeah, absolutely. It's imported crime.
Will you travel around now for that one, or do you know enough about it to write from afar?
I'm definitely planning to. Yeah, you won't be able to get rid of me next year. I'll be here a lot.
So spot Pat Kenny's cousin.
Exactly. Come and meet Pat Kenny's cousin.
Jane Casey, it's an absolute pleasure. Congratulations. The Secret Room is the latest Maeve Kerrigan novel. And thanks for coming and enjoy your visit when you're home for a bit.
Thank you so much.
And we look forward to the next one.
Thanks.
We'll chat again. This week's visiting critic is writer and Irish Times columnist, co-creator of the hugely successful, oh my God, what a complete Aisling series. Never know how to say that exactly. Eimear McGlaisett, welcome to studio.
Good morning, how are you?
Oh my God, what a complete
Ashling. Oh my God, what a complete Ashling.
But that's the one, that's the one. You got to do the coolest thing I think we might have got someone to do as a visiting critic. Tell us what you did.
I got to drive a double-decker Dublin bus. I am thrilled with myself.
Are you a driver generally? Do you like driving?
I do like driving.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I've been driving for 20 plus years and I do enjoy it.
What does it do for you?
Freedom. I grew up in the countryside, in the sticks.
Right.
So freedom to get somewhere when anyone who grew up not adjacent to public transport or walking distance anything knows how important it is to be able to get around. So freedom, being able to just hop into the car and go wherever you want. I'm always very conscious, obviously, of my, you know, carbon footprint and this and that. So I try and not drive when I don't need to. But
use public transport where it's available.
Exactly.
But this is the true independence movement of the Colchis.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
The car.
The car.
So you love a bit of driving. Would you be listening to music or would you be serious? Would you chat?
Back in the day, it would have been a lot of music, a lot of radio. Still listen to the radio a good bit. Have to say that.
Thank you.
I'm in these hallowed halls. I listen to a lot of podcasts and audiobooks.
Very good.
I'm in a choir, so sometimes I'm listening to what we call our line tapes because you have to learn what you have to sing at the next rehearsal. So, yeah.
I don't think I've seen people sing out loud on their own in cars, actually.
Yeah, sometimes if I'm on my way to my choir rehearsal, then I hope my choir mistress Roisin is listening. She'll be, I'm the real lickers now. I'll be like,
all the choir people must be singing in their cars.
Oh, they are, yeah. Yeah, we're on our summer break now, but we have rehearsals on a Wednesday evening and I'd say you can see people converging on the rehearsal space, just singing away in their cars.
My God, we must send someone to a choir at some point as a visiting critic. Come here now, it's a crucial question because do you like driving entirely on your own? Do you mind if there's passengers? Because obviously that's the crux of being a bus driver.
I don't mind passengers. I prefer passengers who also know how to drive themselves because I find if you have someone who's not a driver, they'll be like, oh, just park here. And you'll be like, in that person's garden. Or in that bus lane or drive up that one way street. So I do prefer someone who kind of knows what they're at. But yeah, I have been wanting to drive a bus or just a bigger vehicle for some time.
Uh-huh.
It's just kind of I'd love a go at that.
I always wanted to do this as well. I didn't get to do it. What is it for you?
Just, I think because I like driving and I'm a confident driver, I feel like I think I'd be able to do that. I'd love to give that a go. And you can't say that about a lot of things. And my dad was in the army, but when he retired from the army, he actually got into driving buses and coaches.
Oh, really?
Kind of part-time.
Yeah.
And he loved it. And my brother drives for a living and he has like an articulated truck license.
Oh, wow, so it's in the blood.
It's in the blood, yeah. So,
you're one of the army kids.
Yeah, now we weren't toted around or anything. We stayed at home. But
you didn't have to live in the Curragh or anything?
No. But I did grow up near the Curragh.
Yeah, you did. No
basically
choice.
The same thing. No, my dad was in the Air Corps, so he was based in Baldonnel.
Very good.
So, yes. But he also, I think he took... Now, my dad unfortunately passed away in 2008, so I can't ask him about this.
Yeah.
But he did drive for Dublin Bus in the 70s for a time.
Right.
And he drove the number 10, which no longer exists. But
sadly.
Yeah, so it is definitely in the blood.
I think it's a giant steering wheel for me. It's just all that power.
Steering wheel is giant. Yeah.
And it still is.
It's still, yeah, it was pretty big. If I'm trying to remember now. Yeah, it is pretty big. Your arms are stretched out pretty
okay,
wide.
Very good.
And I wasn't sure. I didn't think they were going to let me drive the bus. I thought maybe 5 feet forward or something.
Amazed.
And these are the buttons and then get out again. But no, I was driving. I was going to say I was changing gears. There's no gears. It's automatic.
Is it?
Yeah. Not in exactly the same way
okay.
as a car in that instead of kind of a, I know for an automatic, you kind of pull, you know, you go from drive to park to neutral, I think, are the three. But it's buttons rather than. Yeah.
Okay. So there's no lever at all.
No, there's the handbrake is very important. There was a lot of handbrake action. No handbrake turns.
And it's a manual, the handbrake?
Yes.
Oh, very good. Yeah. So you've got like a big clunking
It's
lever.
Kind of, yeah, you pull up the little lever and pull
Brilliant.
It back. A very satisfying kind of slotting it into
very
place.
Good.
Yeah.
Very good. So tell us, where did you get to do this, by the
this
way?
This was in the Phibsborough bus depot.
And this is part of a call out that Dublin Bus is doing in general for drivers, particularly women drivers.
They are trying to recruit more women drivers. Yeah. So they have They have lots more. They were saying back in, I think, 2018, 2019, they had 90-something women drivers. Now they have something like 260. So that's a big jump in, you know, 5 or 6 years. But they want even more. So they're having these open days where you can go. And I've seen these advertised. Before you guys asked me to go along and be the visiting critic, I'd seen this advertised and I was like, do I want to change careers and be a bus driver? Maybe. No. So they're having an open day tomorrow, which is Saturday, May 3rd, another one on the 24th. And you do need to sign up, but anyone can go. You just have to have a driving license for 2 years.
Oh, right, a full driver license.
Yeah, so I think it's the B license, which is the kind of the one everyone
gets. And
they'll
train you up. And do you get an additional thing in your, I presume you do. Do you?
Yeah, so I think if you, you know, you apply and you get taken on, they train you how to drive a bus and then you do your bus driver's license.
Okay. And then so you did the preliminary version of all of this?
Yeah, yeah.
It's in Phibsborough.
I think they're holding it in Phibsborough. I think if you just Google, you know, Dublin bus women open day or something,
we'll get the details for the end for sure. And Comirtes, you're in Phibsborough and it's a real double-decker bus.
One of those red ones you see people driving around. Yeah, driver in training.
Do they have a big massive yard up there that you could drive
around? Yeah, they have like a big bus park, I suppose you'd call it. Yeah. But it has a kind of like a racing track, but it's not like a racing track. Shape of a racing track.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
So basically there's an oval that you can drive around.
Yeah.
And there's enough space.
That's fab. Absolutely.
Yeah,
cool. Really
I couldn't believe it. I was like, so I just go, and she was like, yeah, on you go. There was this amazing woman called Tina who has worked for Dublin Bus for quite some time, and she does some of the driver training, and she was telling me how to drive the bus. And they do have in those buses, they have the, so she has controls where she can
like a learner
brake.
Car.
But now she wasn't sitting there for any of my driving training.
Are you
serious? She must have had a lot of confidence. Maybe if I was out on the road, she might have. But no, she was standing beside me, kind of over my left shoulder, telling me how to move off and constantly checking the mirrors. And it was.
The mirrors is also a big attraction for me for the bus. They have giant mirrors. Sure,
they do. Although
things.
The electric buses don't have any mirrors; they have cameras.
Go away.
Now, the bus I was driving wasn't electric. But obviously, a lot of the fleet is now electric. So
they've got screens inside.
I think they've got screens
inside.
In the
cockpit, did you get any terminology? What are they called, their driving position?
I don't remember the word cockpit being used, but I do like that because it sounds. When I was sitting in my driver's cockpit, then, you know, I was constantly checking my mirrors, obviously.
Yes.
Because
you're a brilliant driver.
Diligent driver. Yeah, yeah. But one thing that would terrify me now as a bus driver would be cyclists. I am always very conscious of cyclists and not mowing them down.
Yes.
And I see a lot of my fellow drivers are not so conscious of that.
And when you're on the bike, it's the kind of the mirrors of the bus. You thankfully realise, oh, they can see us. They know what they're doing.
So I would be.
They're the only vehicle that kind of obeys the cycle lane.
Yeah. Yeah. I try. Excuse me.
It would appear at times to my biased mind.
So it was brilliant. Like, I couldn't believe I was driving a bus.
Yeah.
Like, you kind of, once you get into the swing of it, it is kind of, no, it's nothing like driving a car. What am I talking about? The one thing Tina would point, the first thing she said when I got onto it was like, the front wheels are behind you. So when you're in a car, wheels are slightly in front of you.
Course.
So you know where they're
the
turning.
The front of the vehicle.
So
around.
You're moving the, so that's why buses, when you see them pulling up, do you know what really annoys me as a driver? You know the white line before a
Thank
traffic
you.
Light?
Yes. Why does nobody understand?
Driving liquors.
We really are, yeah.
The white line before it, like that's so vehicles like buses can make
can
a turn.
Do the swing, the most obvious thing in the world. Have they never noticed other buses? And their people go, no, I can get all the way to the traffic light.
I'm going
to
go up as far as I can. My nose is going to be whispering off the other cars that are going kind of perpendicular to me.
I love when the bus drivers use the full use of the horn in those situations. They go, what are you doing? I know there's nothing they can do, but it's hopefully for the next time.
Or the bus driver knows the bus isn't going to make it because some idiot has pulled up too far. But he goes to make the turn anyway and then shames them into having to do some kind of reverse.
That's thinking. Yeah, that's right.
And he's just sitting, he or she is just sitting there going, come on, Sonny Jim, move.
Some of the manoeuvres buses have to do with delivery vans parked up in the wrong places.
I know.
That's
and
extraordinary.
Tiny little squinchy streets.
Yeah.
And
this must be in your head when you're doing the.
Yeah. Session. Now, I wasn't really near anything. There was I went around 10 times maybe.
Did you?
Big. Yeah. And there were other buses. There was the odd pedestrian worker who was walking around. There was a couple of cars and there were, you know, the parked buses. But nothing too close that I could possibly have. But I mean, I could have gone rogue. I didn't, thank God.
Is there a top speed limiter on buses?
I don't know, actually. That's a good question.
You don't remember how fast you went at any point?
I wasn't going super fast, no, I have to say. Crawling. But I don't know, do they have it? I don't know if any Dublin bus, I suppose if they're on one of the main roads or on the N11 out there or something, I don't know. I don't know how fast they could get up to.
What buttons did you learn to use other than...
So the buttons to kind of go into drive and park and neutral. I learned there's a button, an emergency button behind a bus driver's left foot. Oh, yeah. So if something is happening and they need help from the control centre or they need them to call the guards, they just move their foot a little bit and press
right.
the button.
Very yeah. clever.
Yeah.
I hope we haven't given a secret away that...
No.
This is the sad part of the Dublin bus job, isn't it? The antisocial behaviour.
Yeah, I did ask about that because I think a lot of people... would be afraid of driving the bus. I'd be more afraid of that, of kind of dealing with the public and dealing with tricky customers and dealing yeah. with antisocial behaviour. But they said that really doesn't come up as much as you would think. And there's loads of support, like that emergency button mm-hmm. and you can connect and meet. Like somebody is always watching where your bus is and what your progress is. Like Fair you're enough. Not on your own.
Yeah.
And I had never really thought about that. I was like, God, it feels a bit lonely sometimes or... would you be afraid? But
is it a good job for women, do you think?
Seems to be, yeah. Like I said, I was asking questions about that. Mm. I love when I get on the bus and see a female bus driver. I'm always a bit more like, hello. Yeah. Hello, my friend.
What is she on
about? One of me.
Because it is low. I think I've read 7.7% or something, even with the improvements.
Yeah, yeah.
There's very few women driving.
Yeah.
But it has very flexible hours. That surely
very
would be a benefit
hours,
for anyone with families.
Lots of different shifts. I was just looking at, like they said, people who drive, new drivers are kind of, you know, they're put across all different kinds of shifts, including night shifts. So there's you have to be prepared to kind of work all those different shifts. But I'd say, like, I'd be lying if I said I wasn't tempted. Like
for a career change.
Yeah. Now, I was obviously so good at the bus driving that they reminded me multiple times that they have openings. So I was like, and you know, they have the signs on the side of the bus that are like, earn €860 a week. And I'm like, that's more than you earn writing books.
Oh, no. Surely not with the success of the Aisleens.
Oh, you'd think, wouldn't you?
Before we leave the buses, by the way, you parked a bus.
I reversed it into a parking space. And Tina said... you would have passed your test on that.
Are you serious?
Oh my, put it on my gravestone.
Oh my God.
Put it on my gravestone with a little tiny bus.
She would have passed the test.
She would have passed the test.
Mary in Galway's texting saying, I have a recurring nightmare that I'm driving a double-decker bus in a crowded street with the steering wheel upstairs. Psychologists, get in touch.
Wow.
The steering wheel is upstairs. Yeah. And she's driving it. And going, oh, no. I don't have any controls over this
that's
careening
horrific.
Bus.
Yeah, that's a real nightmare.
That's a kind of final destination thing ready to happen. How long has the column of the Irish Times been going now?
Oh, that's a great question.
No idea.
Like several years at this point.
I think 6 years we've calculated.
Okay, yeah, that's possible.
Unless I've deleted some of your early material in the archives.
Oh God, imagine.
Is it torture coming up with a new idea every single week?
Yes. I've been writing column, because before I was writing for the Irish Times, I was writing for the Business Post for two or three years before that. So could that be 9 years of coming up with weekly ideas?
It's time to go
of
to the buses,
to
isn't
talk
it?
About. It is torturous.
Shite, though,
it is torturous. It's everything is copy, as we say in the writing industry. And you know, if you don't think I'm getting a column out of driving that bus, then you're going to think I'm
absolutely. You know,
no, it is. I'm always, and sometimes I have a few ideas stacked up, and I'm like, yeah, I'll do that one. Mm-hmm. Depends on how much time I have. Sometimes I leave it very, very late. I like to leave things to the ultimate last minute, and then sometimes, like last week, I was like, what am I going to write this about? And I looked out and saw my friendly neighbourhood squirrel, and I was like, can I get 750 words out of this? Yes.
And you emptied every dry food, nut and seed in the house.
The squirrel saw me coming. I swear to God, and as I said in the column, one of my neighbours is also feeding the squirrels. We only found out when he heard me shaking the nuts out for this squirrel. The squirrels dug up all my plants. because
they had been hiding the nuts.
I gave them the
excess nuts,
and then they took the excess nuts and dug up my plants, and then buried the nuts, and then came back.
They're mobsters.
The thing is, they're fooling themselves because they come back like 20 minutes later for the nuts they buried, so they don't have any willpower.
Absolutely, gougers. Actually, is what they are essentially. So you're not feeding the squirrels. The neighbour still is at it.
Yeah.
And I noticed Fintan O'Toole was writing about how nothing was sacred with all the smartphones in St. Peter's. And you're writing today, smartphones in the Sistine Chapel didn't feel out of place.
Come off it,
celebrity
row. If you were in the Sistine Chapel, there's no way you wouldn't have the phone out for a cheeky snap.
In 2025.
It's 2025. I'm not surprised people were taking photos in the Sistine Chapel.
Including clerics, very senior people.
Yeah.
See the Russian Orthodox guy, he had the phone out for the whole ceremony. He didn't know what was going on.
I mean, it's a once in a lifetime kind of opportunity, isn't it?
I think he was just like browsing. That was the thing.
Maybe he's like, you know, went to Taylor Swift.
Trump
took
had
some
the phone
photo.
Out.
Trump had the phone out. I'd say he always has the phone out.
Simon Harris definitely had the phone out because there's endless photographs of him at the funeral, which appeared to be taken in close proximity. I mean, he cannot resist at all.
Few cheeky snaps.
The Aisling's, is it still happening?
No, we've written 5 books, so that was the end.
The novels are done.
The novels are done,
happening.
But it is still happening. Yeah. So Sarah and I started Substack. Substack is kind of an online publishing platform, kind of a newsletter platform.
Yeah. And growing all the time.
Yeah, yeah. There's so many different things on there. Anything you can think about, you want to read about. So we started the Ballygobbard project. We actually get
a lot of pushback. You've got 2 pronunciations for you.
We call it.
It's your thing.
Ballygobbard. But everyone who's read the books calls it Ballygobbard, and had people, and as Sarah says, it's not a real place, you can call it whatever you want. We just call it Ballygobbard, but people are like, that's very posh. Aisling wouldn't say that.
Because Ballygo Brunch, obviously, which is the cafe she
had. Yeah, and we call it Ballygobbard because it's, I don't know if you know that book and Twitter account, The Irish Four. So the guy who runs that, Dara, said that Ballygobbard means place of the high beak, which just felt very fitting. So Ballygobbard is from Ard, the Irish.
If we look up a Ballygobbard project,
yes,
then
that's
bring
on
it to Substack.
Yeah.
Some of it's free. And then
some of it's free, and then you can sign up for like a fiver a month and you get everything on there.
Yeah. Pay for writing. We're used to that.
Exactly.
Emer McGleiser, thanks a million for coming in. If people are interested in doing something similar to what Emer did, probably not as well, let's face it. Dublin Bus are holding 2 open days. One is tomorrow. The other is the 24th of May. Register on dublinbus.ie for registration, and you'll get a time slot and directions to the location, wherever it will be close to you tomorrow. We look forward to hearing more from you on the Ballygobbard, which really rolls off my tongue, I must say. Emer, good luck. Have a lovely weekend.
Thank you. Bye.
There you go. Some of our favourite conversations from the past week. It's the end of the podcast as you know it. If you have any interesting stories and things you think we definitely should know, sure, pop us an owl email anytime at all. Oliver@rte.ie. Happy weekend to you all, and slán.